From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, more on the state police effort to destroy internal documents. Also today, defending Harvard against claims that it discriminates against Asian American applicants.
If there is any discrimination against Asian Americans in an admissions process, it is not because of affirmative action, it's because of white selection advantage.
And Emerson College professor Jabari Asim on Black Lives in America.
Headlines remind us of all the same and different ways a black body can collide with its inconvenience. Breathing, walking, waiting to cross at the light.
Plus, the Red Sox beat the Yankees. Next, they got to beat the Astros.
Hey, boys, this is a good team and we know it. We got Houston. Let's go.
That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. And once again, public attention turns to the trials of the state police. For the better part of a year now, the organization has been beset by turmoil. Payroll scandals, fake overtime claims, charges of corruption. And now, reporting from WBUR has revealed that the agency sought permission to destroy documents, some dating back decades, that could be essential to future investigations. Joining me now is WBUR digital producer Allie Jarmanning. Hi, Allie.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to sit across from you.
Thanks.
So, tell me the story. What was in these records that the state police wanted to destroy?
Sure. So the first request was made back in March of this year by the state police, and they wanted to destroy time and attendance records for 2010 and 2011, plus billing records, bank records, and 12 years worth of accounting records. So it's a lot of stuff that might
be... It sounds like a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it might be of interest to any investigator or auditor looking into the state police practices, which is happening right now. And so that was the first request. And then a month later in April, state police also petitioned to throw out recruitment and hiring records, personnel and payroll records, and calendars spanning 20 years. And then there was a third similar request in September.
So the state police and other agencies are allowed to destroy records like this, it seems.
Yeah, they are. And the state has this several hundred page document. It's very wonky. It's called the Records Retention Schedule. And it says how long all sorts of different government records need to be kept. So in some cases, it's just a year, like say for something like a meeting notice or job applications. But in other cases, for like a murder file, those need to be kept forever. So yeah, the state police could legally ask for these records to be thrown out.
And they tried.
Yes.
But something got in the way. What stopped the process?
Yeah, so there's this slice of government that I had never heard of. It's the Records Conservation Board. It's made up of appointees from various state agencies and chaired by a lawyer from the Attorney General's office. And the board told the state police, no, you cannot destroy these records. The state police are under investigation, and they tabled any decision pending the ongoing audit.
And were they happy about it? I mean, what has the state police said? Well, first of all, have they said anything about why they made these requests during a time when they're under investigation?
Yeah, so the spokesman for the state police said that they were just following the rules. They were allowed to ask for these documents to be destroyed. And he said none of these documents were actually the subject of any outside investigation or audit. But at the same time, they're going to now keep past payroll records until further notice.
I mean, even though it got stopped, it still seems like it's a pretty big deal. I mean, just the fact that this request was made amidst ongoing investigations.
Yeah, you know, it's all about the timing. That first request in March to throw out attendance records, it was the day after the Boston Globe published a story about payroll records for an entire troop being kept hidden from the public. And the April destruction request was just 2 weeks after Governor Charlie Baker and Colonel Kerry Gilpin held a press conference announcing new reforms and investigations into what was happening at the state police.
So at the very least, it seems like kind of bad judgment in terms of timing. I mean, this is an agency that for the past year has been under intense scrutiny for charges of corruption. I mean, currently six troopers have been charged in federal court with collecting overtime for hours they didn't work. Three more lieutenants are facing charges in Suffolk County. So, Allie, What does this mean to you? How do you read this latest action?
So there's a lot we still don't know about the overtime and payroll scandals within the state police, like how many troopers were putting in these fake time cards, how far back does this practice go, how widespread was it? And you would think that destroying payroll records from as recently as 2011 would make it even harder to find that out. I talked to Greg Sullivan, who's a former state inspector general, and he works at the Pioneer Institute. It's a local think tank. And he said the records would be invaluable to answering some of those questions.
People, the investigative side, wants to know how far back the fraudulent time reporting was goes in this case. And those records would be critically important.
And this seems to follow a pattern for state police. It is an incredibly secretive agency. In fact, state police won the so-called Golden Padlock Award from one journalism group.
Golden Padlock?
Oh, yeah. The investigative reporters and editors every year gives out the Golden Padlock Award.
Beautifully named award.
State police won back in 2015, so this kind of seems to be more of the same.
So has there been comment from the governor's office, from Governor Charlie Baker?
Yeah, he spoke to reporters this morning, and he echoed what we've heard from state police, that, one, the requests fit state protocols when it comes to throwing out records, but he added that they shouldn't be throwing out records right now.
Based on all the existing protocols, what the state police proposed to do fit within those protocols, but the simple truth of the matter is they shouldn't be destroying any payroll records, and they won't be.
And, of course, it is campaign season, so Democratic candidate for Governor Jay Gonzalez also commented on all this today. He said he had some strong words about the way the whole scandal has been handled.
The colonel should be fired. The secretary of public safety should be fired. The governor should appoint someone to lead his state police who's going to root out corruption, someone from the outside who's got credibility.
Gonzalez is calling the request to destroy the documents an attempted cover-up, but in this case, it looks like the board did what it's supposed to do. It stopped potentially important documents from being destroyed.
Those are fiery words from Jay Gonzalez. Fired. Anyway, that's WBUR digital producer Allie Jaramanic. Thank you, Allie, for putting up with me and for joining us.
Oh, anytime.
The Red Sox got it done last night, holding off the Yankees to reach their first American League Championship Series since 2013. It's not actually that far back, but still,
I mean,
feels like it sometimes.
It's far enough. That's 5 years without getting to the ALCS. Come on.
Title town. In case you're wondering whose voice that is, that's Radio Boston's own Chris Siderick. I'll finish setting up and we'll get back. No.
You can't give me an opening like that. Come on.
The Sox still have a couple of series to win. Next, the Houston Astros, who happen to have beaten the Sox 4 times this year. Bad omen, or just lulling the Astros into a false sense of security? Joining me now is the person I just mentioned, Chris. How you doing?
What's going on, Evan?
Not much. So, last night's game, it was a big game for the obvious reason. I mean, the Sox moving forward. Was also steeped in history. Give us a little perspective.
Well, Red Sox-Yankees, you're talking about maybe the greatest rivalry in all of sports. And this was, believe it or not, the first time that these two teams have met in the playoffs since 2004. 2004, obviously, cowboy up the incredible 3-0 comeback. So you were expecting to see some drama between these two teams, and it didn't start out right away that way. But by game two, Yankees beat the Red Sox at Fenway, and Aaron Judge, of all people, he's supposed to be a nice guy, this is kind of out of character for him, walks by the Red Sox clubhouse blasting New York, New York, which they play at Yankee Stadium all the time. So anyway, the Sox turn around and win game three in an absolute blowout, 16-1. When teams tend to score a lot of runs like that, a lot of times they come back a little bit lackluster on the offensive side the next game. But they ended up finishing it off in game four. That's actually 4 consecutive wins now for the Red Sox at Yankee Stadium in the playoffs,
that
which is phenomenal.
That can't feel good for New York, New York.
Exactly. And that led to this scene in the Red Sox clubhouse. I don't know about you. There is nothing better to me as a sports fan than teams who legitimately don't like each other. And it's starting to feel like these two teams don't like each other, which is great. The rivalry is back.
Oh, but it's over.
Yes.
Not over. Yeah. I mean, let's
talk Yankees,
about what
over.
Turned out to be a great game. I mean, talk to me about Rick Porcello's start. He comes in, has a shutout for the first 4 innings, runs into some trouble against Gary Sanchez in the 5th, lets up a run. What'd you think about the call, Alex Cora's call, to pull him when he did. That's Red Sox manager Alex Cora.
Yeah, I understand it. I think you could make an argument both ways on that. Porcello was cruising for most of the game. He did run into a little bit of trouble in the fifth. I thought more questionable was pulling Chris Sale in the eighth inning, and we can get to that. But really the reason to question the move to pull Porcello is because the bullpen has just been so, so bad. And really you don't know who your go-to guys are in the bullpen, which is always a troubling thing. But he went to Matt Barnes in the sixth, got a 1-2-3 inning, clean seventh from Ryan Brazier. And then Chris Sale, as I said, in the eighth. That is a really interesting move, and we'll come back to that. But Chris Sale gets through the eighth, doesn't put on a runner, and that brings us to the ninth inning with a 3-run lead. You would think that'd be safe, right?
No, I wouldn't, because I've watched a lot of Red Sox games over the years, and I know what happens in the ninth inning. And it seemed like it might. They start the inning up 4-1, then Craig Kimbrel comes in to close. He's usually pretty automatic, but we need drama. It's the Red Sox game. It's the ninth inning. Walk us through it.
So I couldn't believe it. I'm watching this game, and he walks Aaron Judge on four straight pitches and doesn't even look close. I mean, his control is off. He ends up loading the bases, hits Neil Walker, so walks in a run, essentially, and then Gary Sanchez comes up. Now, Gary Sanchez, big-time home run hitter. And here he is, can win it all with one swing of the bat, and that led to this.
Here's Gary Sanchez. That'll be a 3-2. Bases loaded, one out. And here's the payoff. Swung on, a high fly to left. Benintendi back on the track, near the wall, makes the catch. The third run scores. That's Didi. Echevarria holds it second. Sanchez didn't miss by much.
Didn't miss by much is underselling it. I was watching Benintendi back up, and it was absolutely terrifying. And I wasn't the only one that felt that way. Xander Bogaerts was asked about it after the game. He actually said, quote, "Gary Sanchez hit that ball up in the air, and I'm like, oh, my God." Then you've got Benintendi slowly going back to the wall, and I'm like, stop going back. You're making me nervous. He's making us all nervous.
I mean, you could hear it. You could hear it, the breath of the entire stadium.
And what's crazy is in the old days, that play goes the Yankees' way. He hits the home run. I mean, I'm Aaron Boone, their manager, 2003. That home run goes over the wall. But it feels like post-2004, post-curse world, it didn't shake out that way.
Here he comes, the 1-2. Bouncing ball, going to be a tough play. Nunez gloves, throws, and in time for the out. The Red Sox will celebrate, but there will be a challenge you can guarantee. Here comes the call. He is out, and that's it. The Boston Red Sox win the division series.
Even on that last play, they had to go to a challenge. This team is not short on drama.
I mean, radio is great in that you get the excitement, but you really can't appreciate the play, which was amazing. I mean, just with Eduardo Nunez getting that ball, deciding to throw what could easily have been an errant throw and costing the game. But
I would argue that throw was an errant throw, and it was the incredible stretch by Steve Pierce that saved maybe not only that game, but the series itself, because you've used Chris Sale in the eighth inning. If they lose that game, and if that throw had gotten past Steve Pierce at first base, they would have lost the game. You don't probably aren't starting Chris Sale in game five. Who do you start? David Price? Yikes.
Well, David Price isn't going to disappear for the rest of the playoffs, so we have to get that. Get that arm working.
I don't know that I'd start him, to be honest. I might put him in the bullpen. I mean, it's so obvious the guy cannot handle the spotlight.
Well, at least they have a manager who seems to have acquitted himself well in this series. Certainly outmanaged Aaron Boone, who stuck with pitchers for too long on several occasions. So, naturally, the question becomes, how will Alex Cora apply his instincts to Houston, who the Sox will start playing on Saturday? And after the game last night, reporters asked him how he was thinking about it.
They have a good team. What they did to the Indians, that was impressive. They can pitch. They're playing good defense. They're swinging the bat well. I've been talking about them the whole season. So now we go. You know, best of seven. They know me. I know them. It should be fun.
And he doesn't mean that in a vague way. When he says, they know me, I know them, he was a bench manager with the Astros last year. Does that give him an advantage? He knows how the team works. Or does it give the Astros an advantage? They know what's going on in his head.
It's an interesting question, and we'll kind of have to see how it plays out. I don't know. I think Alex Cora has shown that as the manager, he's willing to do whatever it takes to win, regardless of what it might mean for the future. See the Chris Sale move from last night. It's interesting. He brings Sale in the eighth inning. Last year, the Astros manager, A.J. Hinch, actually did almost the same exact thing with their ace, Justin Verlander. And Cora criticized it at the time. He said, what are you doing? If we lose this game, we don't have him for game five. Seems to have reversed his thinking about that. Maybe being in the hot seat made the difference.
Well, he saw that it worked.
Yeah, fair enough. It's a risk-reward thing, I think.
So this game against the Astros, the series against the Astros, a rematch, chance for vindication. Last year in the division series, the Astros beat the Sox and then went on to win it all. So let's do like a pre-postmortem here. Like, let's say we're talking in 10 days or something, and the Sox have lost. Why do you think they will have lost? That is, if things go wrong, what do you expect it is that will go wrong?
Pitching. 100% pitching. You've got Chris Sale, who looked pretty good in game one. He'll go. But after that, where do you go? And then also the bullpen is a problem. So I think it's pitching up and down the roster. We'll have to see kind of how they match up against Astros hitters.
And the Astros pitching is phenomenal.
Yes. I mean, the Astros are a great team. They are peaking at the right time. I am very worried for the Red Sox in this series. I think if I were a betting man, I would have to pick the Astros. And I hope I'm wrong.
I think but folks in Vegas agree with you, right? The line favors the Astros at the moment. I mean, so let's say we go the other way. 10 days from now, we're talking, and the Red Sox have pulled it out. What went right? What did they do right? How did they pull it out?
I think the key is going to be offense. If they're able to score and potentially score first in a lot of these games, I think that will really make the difference. According to ESPN, playoff teams who have scored first are 14-2 this year in the playoffs. It's always great to get those runs on the board early.
So look forward to Saturday, see if they can put up some runs early.
Saturday and Sunday. It's going to be an interesting weekend.
That's Radio Boston's Chris Sidorek. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz, ready to delve deeper into the combustible trial that starts next week, the one that charges Harvard University with discriminating against Asian American applicants.
You have people that are being admitted because of the color of their skin, as such a significant factor that it overwhelms other considerations. As the statistics show, at any given level of qualification, it's that much harder to get in if you're an Asian American applicant than white, than Latino, than black.
That's Ilya Shapiro of the Cato Institute. We spoke to him yesterday. He's backing Students for Fair Admissions. They're the anti-affirmative action group behind the lawsuit. But Harvard vigorously denies these claims, insisting that applicants are evaluated in a holistic way, and that their admissions processes are consistent with their well-established legal right to admit a diverse student body. So today we get some more insight into that argument from Nicole Ochi, the supervising attorney for Asian Americans Advancing Justice, Los Angeles. They're a nonprofit legal aid and civil rights organization representing a group of Harvard students who've decided to back their school and defend affirmative action. She joins us from, not surprisingly, Los Angeles. Hello, Nicole.
Hi.
So you just heard just a first clip from what Ilya Shapiro was arguing yesterday, that admitting people because of their skin color is harming Asian Americans. Did you have a response?
Yes. I think that statement is completely factually inaccurate for several reasons.
No, give me the reasons.
Okay. So first of all, there is no evidence that anyone is getting in only because of their race. In fact, the evidence in the Harvard case shows that race has less of an impact on admissions decisions than class, than geographic location, than majors, etc. And also, number two, there is a conflation of two issues that are happening in this case, and I believe in the media as well, which are reflected in your other guests' comments. Now, there is a difference between discrimination against Asian Americans vis-a-vis white applicants and whether an affirmative action or race-conscious admissions policy is unduly burdening Asian Americans. And it's really important to take apart those two things, because getting rid of race as a positive consideration in the admissions process will do nothing to address whether or not Asian Americans are discriminated against in favor of whites.
That's interesting because, I mean, the argument they're making seems to be just an argument about fairness on some level. Mm-hmm. Asian American applicants to Harvard have the highest academic credentials on average, but the lowest overall acceptance rates. How is that not a burden on Asian American applicants?
So there's a couple of reasons why that question, I guess, embedded in that question, there are some misunderstandings about the admissions process. So I think first and foremost, it's important to understand that traditional academic indicators of qualifications like SAT scores and grades do not matter that much in elite school admissions.
Because so many of the people who apply have extremely high traditional academic credentials.
That's right. You know, they couldn't even admit as many people as apply who have perfect SAT scores and GPAs.
Right.
And so, of course, it's going to depend on other factors. I think another thing that needs to be, another myth, I guess, that needs to be dispelled about the admissions process is that these traditional academic indicators actually tell us anything, really, about an applicant's potential for success as a student and as a person later in life. Now, does it give some baseline understanding of qualifications? Yes, but it tells very little beyond that. So there's, for example, a student that gets a 1300 on the SAT and a student that gets a 1400 on the SAT. All that really tells us is both of those students, even though one got 100 points higher, are likely to get somewhere between an A- and a C+ average GPA as a freshman. That's all. That's all it ever tells us. It doesn't tell us anything about graduation rates, about later success. And in fact, it tells us a lot more about a person's race or class than anything else.
So, I mean, do you acknowledge, though, that, I mean, Harvard's own history shows that race can be used as a factor in a discriminatory way. I mean, in the 20s, as a response to an increasing number of Jewish students being accepted, the school instituted a character-based component to admissions. And that essentially allowed the school to discriminate against Jewish applicants with a de facto quota. Is the suggestion that such a thing is impossible or just that it isn't what's happening now?
No, definitely. I don't think it's impossible that Harvard discriminated against Jewish applicants in the past, nor that Asian Americans experience discrimination in many aspects of life today. What I do dispute is that Harvard's intentional use of race to ameliorate past and current discrimination, to make its campuses more diverse and inclusive, and to provide opportunities to identify the most promising candidates that may be obscured by racial biases in traditional metrics, is anything like excluding a group because of their race.
So I will say, Shapiro, that's Ilya Shapiro, who we talked to yesterday, he went further than this. He actually questioned the very idea that racial and ethnic diversity is a commendable goal for universities.
I think there's value in having different backgrounds. I don't think there's value in judging people based on skin color. That's what, for me, it comes down to.
So do you see diversity as an inherent and essential good in higher education?
Certainly, I see that as the case. But I also want to say that I actually didn't hear him disputing that. I heard him parroting another myth or a lie that people are being judged based on the color of their skin. Now, that is not what's happening in a race-conscious admissions policy. And it's also, you could say that about SAT scores. Using SAT scores is judging people based on the color of their skin because we continue to use them even though we know that it systematically penalizes certain types of students. But to get back to your other question about whether diversity is a good, yes, I believe it is incredibly important. I represent a number of prospective current Harvard students, as well as alum of Harvard, who have all attested to the benefits of diversity. Right? For students who have always been a racial minority, whether they be Asian Americans in a predominantly white environment in high school, or whether it's, you know, folks who are underrepresented at Harvard itself, which are Black and Latino students, they have all attested to the fact that diversity, racial diversity, is critical for them to not feel racially isolated, to not feel, you know, under scrutiny or attacked. They've also all said that racial diversity has tremendously helped them in their own education. It has changed them, right? There are students that I represent who were never involved before in, like, helping their community or caring about social justice, who, because of the diversity there, are interested in that. And other people who maybe always had that bent of social justice have also said that the progress that Asian Americans have made, for example, in advocating for an ethnic studies program at Harvard is building upon the decades of work that Black and brown communities have built at Harvard. And so their work as Asian American activists fighting against bias, against discrimination, fighting for a better place for themselves as Asian Americans at Harvard would not have been possible without their fellow Black and Latino students who both work with them now and pave the way for their current work.
It's an interesting perspective. It does raise a question of whether it could be done differently, though. That is, even if diversity has all of these benefits, might it not be possible to achieve a kind of racial diversity on campus in a race-blind admissions, through a race-blind admissions process, one that focused, say, on economic backgrounds, or that involved the lottery system, or that took the top students from school? Are there other race-blind ways to achieve diversity?
So I have two responses to that. One is that no, it's not possible, and we've seen that time and time again. In California, where I'm from, we have not had race-conscious admissions in the University of California system since 1996, and we have never achieved the racial diversity that we had before the ban was put in place. In the UT Austin case, which went before the Supreme Court twice in the last few years, there was the same analysis there, and that's why the Supreme Court upheld that case. When UT Austin stopped considering race, its diversity plummeted, and more and more white students got in. Not more and more Asian students, by the way. More and more white students were getting in than any other racial minority. So no, I think that the research shows and the experience of these different institutions shows that race-neutral, alternatives do not work. And even in this case, I think both experts agree that removing the consideration of race would result in a dramatic, at least 30% decline in African-American representation at Harvard. Now, the second thing I want to say to address that is more of a philosophical rather than like a statistical question, which is, how do you have a holistic admissions process where you look at where someone lives and their background, their socioeconomic background, what their parents do, et cetera, et cetera? You look at the whole person. That's what you're supposed to do, but you're ignoring their race. Like, how can you do that? Because someone's race is an integral part of their identity and who they are. And many of the students that I represent were told, don't disclose your race in the admissions process because it might penalize you. But none of them felt comfortable doing that because they were like, that's erasing me. That's erasing my family, my community. I'm not willing to give that up. And so they all wrote about their race in their admissions essays. They all, you know, disclosed it. They checked the box. And obviously, all the ones that I represent got in.
So far, this discussion sort of been about the theoretical underpinnings, the ethics of it. The legal question is a little narrower, right? Because the Supreme Court and various rulings have allowed for a kind of very, given schools a very narrow opportunity to make use of race. So there's a broad question, the one we're talking about, is affirmative action justifiable for all these reasons? The other question is the legal question, will Harvard's practice withstand scrutiny from the courts? Do you think Harvard's practices will withstand that scrutiny?
Yes, I certainly believe that it will withstand that scrutiny because One of the hallmarks of a constitutional race-conscious admissions program is that it is narrowly tailored to achieve racial diversity, and that there are no quotas, that there is no racial balancing, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no evidence of that here. I mean, Asian American admission rates have increased by about 25%, I believe, since 2010. There is absolutely no evidence that Asian Americans are being put in a separate admissions process where they're only competing against each other. And race is used flexibly. At least three of the students that I represent who are Asian American reviewed their admissions files, and they saw how their race was considered as a plus factor as Asian American. So it's not like race-conscious admissions policies are only being used to benefit African American and Latino students, which seems to be the assumption on the other side. That's, the evidence doesn't bear that out.
Well, I guess we'll see whether that reasoning holds up now that we have a firmer five conservative majority Supreme Court and a Justice Department that has weighed in on the side of the organization that is suing Harvard. That was Nicole Ochi, the supervising attorney for Asian Americans Advancing Justice, a nonprofit legal aid and civil rights organization. Nicole, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
There's just something about college towns in New England. The coming and going of students, the home team pride, and of course the mutual resentment between town and gown, cloistered campus and the real world around it. Take Amherst, where UMass is described as a city unto itself. But the New England News Collaborative's Jill Kaufman has some collegial news. Some people from the school and community are trying to bring everyone together with art.
If you've been walking or driving around Amherst from the middle of UMass toward the center of town, you may have seen some unexpected objects near walkways or on a grassy hill.
So this is Ben Jones' piece up here.
Sandy Litchfield is one of the curators of this outdoor multi-piece exhibit called Crosstown Contemporary Art. Ben Jones's piece is a fiberglass 3D map set atop uneven steel legs. It's completely gray, except for three miniature billboards with the same message.
And on one side of the billboard, it says, "All the time in the world." And on the other side of the billboard, it says, "Running out of time."
Litchfield is an artist who teaches in UMass's architecture department. She and other art educators from the Museum of Contemporary Art at UMass have been working on this for almost 3 years. The idea, curator Ava Fierst says, is to use art as an indirect path to bust through what she says is a big problem.
There is a huge psychological barrier between the town of Amherst and University of Massachusetts.
Of course, there are specific things, Fierst says. Rowdy students, traffic, parking, an uninviting, physically intimidating campus. Especially at the center of it all, the building most likely to be used by the public, the school's Fine Arts Center, a brutalist-era design with the art museum in the basement. But art, Fierst says, can be the fix.
Yeah, it makes people think and reflect and possibly discover that the threshold between Amherst and UMass is not quite as high.
Another piece on North Pleasant Street is Ghost Shed by artist Tom Friedman, number 7 on an audio tour you can use.
The idea for this piece initially came from the site, which had several frat houses.
And I was Friedman's sculpture looks like a very small house frame built with 2x4s painted white. It sits on what used to be called Frat Row. Parties there once contributed to the school's ZooMass label. The houses and a few hundred frat members were adjacent to a quiet neighborhood. The buildings, privately owned, were demolished around 2006. UMass now owns the land, more genteelly referred to as Frat Green. Town officials have been open to all of this. The challenges have been manageable, but many, as this is 13 pieces set up on town and school property, requiring land permits and liability insurance. Mowing the grass around the sculptures was a problem, and the summer heat melted the fixant on one piece, which collapsed. And almost immediately, the inviting piece, Common Sounding, by Erica Zikos, up near the town's new rotary, had to be dismantled because of noise complaints from neighbors. First, its metal pipes meant to be played were stuffed with cloth. Then they were removed altogether, rehung for special events. The sculptures get more interactive as you go toward town into Kendrick Park. You can even sit inside Sarah Brayman's sculpture, and we are.
The piece is called Day Trip, and it's made from a concrete drainage culvert.
The culvert's openings are covered with colored glass.
I've got a blue piece on the circle on the top and a pink and a purple piece.
As the sun moves, the colors move along the culvert's walls. Brayman says families play in the sculpture during the day, and at night, homeless people have been sleeping here. She's okay with that. She points over to a construction site across the way where a modern apartment complex is going up. It may be a stretch, she says, but maybe all this art can get people to talk more about Amherst's need for affordable housing.
You're the artist?
Amherst resident Ed Wilford rides up on his bike.
Are there any beyond that?
He says he saw the other sculptures and he didn't know they were part of an exhibit. It turns out a few years ago, Wilford assigned himself the job of keeping track of the town's art exhibits. They're up for a month or two, he says, and then they're gone. Even this exhibit could be forgotten. So his notes go into the town archives.
If there's a record of it, if there's a paper trail, then it can be dug out and say, see, Amherst has been an art town.
And a college town, and a town where people live. There are no guarantees this exhibit will change things, the curators say. That's up to the people, not the art.
That story from New England News Collaborative reporter Jill Kaufman. Stay with us. After the break, we're joined by Jabari Asim on his new book, We Can't Breathe. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Here are some of the barbs Jabari Asim thinks self-styled liberals should get more comfortable throwing around if they care about advancing the cause of racial equality. Duplicitous. Racist. Delusional. Confederate. Intellectually challenged. Or how about flaccid? There's more where those came from, etched into Asim's latest book of essays, We Can't Breathe, Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival. Just so you know, these aren't the kinds of essays that end with a simple argument, you know, this is what we need to overcome racism or this other thing. They're more like explorations, weaving past and present, art and news to paint a multidimensional picture of black life in America. Here's a scene reading from his book on the burden African Americans carry just walking around.
Headlines remind us of all the same and different ways a black body can collide with its inconvenience, breathing, walking, waiting to cross at the light, using a golf club as a cane while crossing a Seattle intersection, heading home while carrying candy and a can of iced tea. Any of these can be seen as unforgivable trespass, alien intrusion on ground that must be defended. The wrongful arrests, the point-blank executions, the gunshots to the back, the militarized police responses, the illuminating silence of white self-styled liberals, and most critical, the paucity of convictions, all point to the same existential question. How can we strut in a strange land?
Jabari Asim, reading from his new book of essays, We Can't Breathe. He's the former editor of The Crisis, the journal of the NAACP, and a professor at Emerson College. He joins me now in the studio. Jabari, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Evan. I'm glad to be here.
It's my first time sitting across from you, so I'm excited to have you here. So, one of the really remarkable things about the book, for me anyway, is just the sweep of past and present. And start with the opening essay, which is about lying. Yeah, it's a common topic in the Trump era because of the role lies have played in presidential communication. But your point is deeper. Like, for black Americans, it's always been an era of lies. This is not the era of lies. It's always been an era of lies. So why did you start your book there? What do lies mean?
Well, I was kind of fascinated by just the idea of stories clashing. And in my classes, I use this quote from Muriel Rukeyser, where she says, essentially, the universe is not made of atoms, it's made of stories, right? And so we often look at dissent and difference as a matter of clashing civilizations, clashing values. Well, I'm a storyteller, so I look at them as a clash of stories. And so one of the things I'm looking at is the story of the African-American experience here in the United States and the ways in which it has been distorted and twisted and ways in which we can combat that.
And the lying framework, it's important to you because of partly the way your father thought about lying and the way that resonated with your experience of this twisted nature of
I talk about that in the book. I mean, I do start to go from the personal to larger stories. But in our household, my father sort of policed our vocabularies. There were certain words. Actually, there was a pretty long list of words that we weren't allowed to say or to say to each other. I'm one of six children. And one thing we couldn't do is call each other liars. My father's reaction to that word was something to watch. It really upset him, the idea that we could accuse each other of something as treacherous as falsehoods.
And now everyone is accusing everyone, yes, every other person of falsehoods, yes, all the time. There's a lot also in the story, so between the personal and the national, that is local. I mean, about Boston's legacy of racism. Like, tell us, for instance, about the slave wall you stumbled across in Medford.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for it... when I was just going by in a car and it said slave wall, but
we, just it said slave
wall.
Yeah,
and we know who built the wall. We know his name. His name is Pomp. We know when he built it. So I thought, wouldn't it be just so much more simpler and clearer to say it's Pomp's wall?
How do we know who built the wall and when? How did you uncover it?
There's a very good historical society in Medford, and they have a wonderful website. And there are people who've done this work. So since this work has been done, I'm saying, you know, why not bring it out into the light?
Yeah. And even the names are interesting. That is, you point out in this piece that the name Pomp, it's connected to a whole bunch of sort of exaggerated, highfalutin kind of names. That,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, slaveholders, I don't know if it was, you know, their own limited view of heroism or maybe some warped idea of irony. I don't know. But they often gave the lowliest members of society, the people whom they claimed to own as property, these really lofty names. They named them after generals and philosophers and orators. And it's just...
It's like a sick joke. It's hard to get into the mind of someone,
right,
who would do this.
I'm hesitant to speculate, but one does wonder. Yes.
Yeah. And there's a lot more forgotten racism in Greater Boston. I mean, do you feel it when you're walking around? Everything from, you know, the fights over Yawkey Way and Faneuil Hall...
Yeah, I think, I mean, like sometimes I find myself, I think it's in Cambridge, and I'm walking down a street called Agassiz. And in a previous book, I wrote about, you know, Agassiz's scientific racism and his white supremacy. And it's just ironic to kind of, I even was visiting in a church here one time, and the pastor began his sermon with a big picture of Agassiz, Louis Agassiz, and used him in his sermon as this wonderful guy. And I thought, you know, it's really interesting how we can approach a narrative from different angles and come away with
Listeners a little more about...
Well, Agassiz, you know, he argued, he came to Harvard to found a scientific school, and he argued that the mind of a white infant 3 months in the womb was superior to the brain of a fully adult African-American. So, you know, he made these kinds of arguments that are, you know, sick.
Yeah. There are also moments in the book where you get to express some real pride in your racial identity. The section on your family, for instance, both the family where you grew up and the family you've created, but also the section you read from on strutting, which sounds kind of trivial, but which you paint as quite potent. What does strutting mean to you?
Well, I'm totally fascinated. I mean, one of the things that I look at a lot in my work is how the black body moves through public spaces, right? And so strutting is sort of the black body moving at its best when everything is working. But it's we are moving in a society that often has no room for us, that doesn't actually want us there. So I look at the idea of the black body moving through certain kinds of spaces, actual, you know, geographical, but also metaphorical.
And everything from moving through it with this kind of pride that comes with strutting to the kind of dangers that come with all walking around.
Walking out of bounds, walking from a convenience store to one's father's home, for example, walking to a playground to play. So many of these things end tragically.
Yeah. The final essay of the book is where you really sort of turn directly to politics. It's interesting that you wait for the final essay to do it. Were you trying to avoid it throughout?
There was some thought in how the essays were arranged, yes.
So it's focused partly around this famous moment when Michelle Obama defended liberal values against conservative attacks, saying, when they go low, we go high. But you're fatigued, I would say, maybe, by this notion of respectability politics and the need to go high. Why? What's wrong with going high?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have to point out that this particular argument against the politics of respectability is one that the Black Lives Movement has really pushed to the forefront. But there used to be this idea that if we claimed as oppressed people, if we claimed the moral high ground, then we could sway the consciences of those who choose to oppress us. And I do argue that that's an outdated method. I think the best way to appeal to people who oppress you is to appeal to their self-interest. I don't think that they are likely to make concessions in terms of fairness or equality or justice because it's the right thing to do. I think you have to point out how it benefits them. Mm.
I think one reason that people stick with this argument is because it's partly the way we remember civil rights, right?
Sure.
The side of civil rights that gets remembered is the placating side, right?
Right.
The turn the other cheek side.
Right, right.
I mean, is that problematic in itself that that's the side we remember?
Well, I can see that the side of kneeling, praying protesters in their Sunday best being attacked by water hoses did indeed sway the consciences of some Americans. But I would argue that that was a small group of people. And I think it's an outdated notion. And I think that the rights and privileges of citizenship should go to all African-American citizens, whether they're choir boys or not. The fact that they are Americans on American soil, born and raised, should entitle them to the rights and privileges that everyone else gets.
And bound up with this as a fatigue with respectability politics is some harsh criticism for white liberals, which, again, has an interesting history in Boston. We'll get to that in a second. But, you were motivated to direct some anger in that direction. Share.
It's just that I don't know if you're referring to a specific instance in the
No, it's just a general sense that, like, white liberals don't take the kinds of risks that would make them real allies in the movement for equality. That was the sense I get. I mean, tell me I'm wrong.
Yeah. No, I think that, I mean, we have hashtag activism now, and we have a lot of well-meaning liberals who will, you know, hashtag Trayvon Martin, but they're not going to call their legislator. They're not going to challenge stand your ground laws. They're not going to risk their physical health by marching. They're not going to do any of the things that those of us who don't have the luxury of hiding behind a hashtag have to do. It's not a matter of choice for us. I mean, I have four sons. It's not a matter of choice for me. But I do think that the silence in particular of white liberals, both in social media and in actual spaces, is troubling and illuminating.
Let's get to the local stuff there. One thing it reminded me of just being in Boston is that we have a history in Boston of, like, white abolitionism, which was a kind of powerful ally for the black anti-slavery movement in the 19th century. And it made me think, is that a model for a better kind of partnership? Or is it better not to have a partnership if white liberals aren't going to take the kinds of risks necessary?
I think that the energy of white liberals is best directed toward their own communities. So we all have these conversations with white liberals over the water cooler where they talk about Thanksgiving and they talk about their racist relatives and how difficult it was. I'd rather have that energy be directed toward their own racist families, toward members of their own communities, than to my community. I think that would be a really effective form of allyship, if you will.
Hmm. You also are critical of the media and the role the media has played. What are we doing wrong?
Well, long-term member of the media myself, so I'm complicit in this as well. But I think we tiptoe around the idea of racism. We put racist in quotes all the time. We say Walter Scott was allegedly shot in the back by a police officer, even though, you know, we can all see the video and the police officer is shooting him in the back. So I think the sort of tiptoeing around declarative language doesn't benefit progressives, certainly doesn't benefit members of oppressed groups in society.
Do you worry that using more direct language of that sort as media institutions would only increase the lack of trust that large swaths of America seem to have in the media?
Well, I would prioritize knowledge and information over trust. I think it's better to be informed.
You find yourself hopeful, despairing?
I think I'm gonna quote James Baldwin. Despair is a luxury that only white men can afford.
All right, I guess that puts you on one side. So finally, and I have to admit this is a weird place to end, but the title, you know, we Can't Breathe. Of course, in the most immediate sense, it harkens back to the death of Eric Garner, the hands of police officers in New York in 2014. He said 11 times he couldn't breathe as he was held in a chokehold. But in the book, you remind us that phrase has a longer history.
Yes. Yeah, I talk about the novels of an African-American writer named Ronald Fair, and one of his novels was actually called We Can't Breathe, and it turns on a police killing of an unarmed black man. So I say, you know, before it became a rallying cry more recently, it's always been sort of a ringing declaration of intent.
So do you see, and this we'll just have to make this quick, but do you see history as being that linear from slavery to lynching to civil rights to Eric Garner? I mean, does it just...
To me, it's more like concentric circles. You know, there's overlapping where some things are actually repeated, and then there are other things that are brand new.
Jabari Asim, former editor of NAACP's Journal of the Crisis. He's a professor of creative writing at Emerson College and author of several books, including his latest, We Can't Breathe. He'll be at the Boston Book Festival this Saturday and at the Harvard Bookstore on October 19th. There's more information about those events and the book at our website, radioboston.org. Jabari, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Evan.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.